This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Linda Mottram. In this episode, what's the state of protection for aged care residents in this country when a home can close unannounced? Why organised drug crime is overwhelming Australia's policing strategy? And a waste crisis in Australian healthcare. Welcome to the program. The nation has passed a significant milestone. The average Australian is a millionaire. The Australian Bureau of Statistics says average household wealth has passed the $1 million mark thanks to years of surging property prices and growing superannuation balances for those who have them. That's the upside. The downside is that the poorest 20% of us control less than 1% of all household wealth, with average wealth of those Australians currently a fraction over $35,000. So is there any sign that we are lifting the least well off? Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
Spoiling children on their birthday is just the way it is for many Australian parents. For Jenny, it was the start of a nightmare. She sought help from the Salvation Army, and financial counsellor Kristen Hartnett was there to pick up the pieces.
She did not have the cash from her Centrelink benefits. So a toy that would generally cost $250 at Harvey Norman, an electronic toy, she took out a consumer lease, and that ended up costing her $1,200.
Jenny didn't have the money up front, so she effectively leased the toy so her daughter could unwrap a present on her birthday. Consumer leases, where you pay for a product over time, often on a high interest rate without ultimately owning it, can send those on very low incomes into financial stress.
Yeah, it's distressing and upsetting when we see people trying to be a mum and just provide for a child's birthday, that it actually puts them into a cycle of poverty that then puts other basic needs at risk. And that might be paying the rent, paying the electricity and paying off other, you know, bills.
Last year, the Productivity Commission revealed wealth inequality in Australia, or the gap between the haves and the have-nots, was growing, but not by much at all. It did, however, show that over the decade, those in or near poverty have found it very difficult to break out of that. Today's Bureau of Statistics figures highlight the extent of that problem. Here's the Bureau's chief economist, Bruce Hockman.
Bottom end, the average household wealth is only $35,000 being accumulated over, you know, the average working life as well. So that's,
does that concern you at all as a data cruncher?
Well, as a data cruncher, I suppose it's my job to crunch the data, report the facts, and let others make judgments about what they should do about those facts.
Deloitte Access Economics partner Nikki Hutley says she's happy to make a judgment on what should be done about it.
Look, this is something that worries all economists and should worry all politicians, is the inequity that is in our society between those that have and those that don't have.
Nikki Hutley, Deloitte Access Economics has the ear of the government, both sides of Parliament. Is there any resistance to policies that would really help those on very low incomes to perhaps move up a couple of income brackets?
We'd say, of course, that, you know, things like there's been a huge resistance to increasing Newstart, and that there's a misperception of why people are on Newstart and how long they are on Newstart for. Some of the things that we require those less well-off to do to even get their Newstart, if you think about the Community Development Program or some of the Parents Next programs that make it very hard for people to even get that basic income, I think there's a lot more that we can do.
On the flip side, the top 20% of households are doing very well, holding 60% of overall wealth, or averaging $3.2 million in assets, many with multiple properties and bulging super accounts. The Bureau of Statistics, Bruce Hockman again.
Thinking about it in layman's terms, you know, it's the wealthy people that live in the harbourside mansions, and it's the other end of the scale living out in the distant suburbs from the capital cities.
For those diligently squirreling away every cent, building wealth just got a little more challenging. Today, the National Australia Bank announced the ongoing savings rate of its iSaver accounts have been cut to 0.11 of a percentage point. And the ANZ, which passed on the RBA's full interest rate cut to borrowers in July, has cut the interest rate for its saver accounts to 0.15 percentage points. The Salvation Army's Kristen Hartnett again.
We know that, you know, we all are in different stories and we have different situations, and it's how can we work together to actually make a difference for people who are doing it tough in a very genuine circumstance?
Kristen Hartnett from the Salvation Army with our business reporter David Taylor. Families caught up in the sudden closure of a Queensland aged care facility are unsurprisingly demanding answers. The facility on the Gold Coast had to relocate more than 70 residents after a contract dispute with the care providers. Along with the residents, everything was stripped from the building, from medication to cutlery. Aged care experts say it's bizarre and unprecedented, but what are the rights and protections for residents? Isabel Rowe reports.
Lorraine Cook was doing the shopping yesterday afternoon when she got an urgent call from the Earl Haven Retirement Village on the Gold Coast. Her husband John was there and was forced out just before midnight.
Going from a nice room on his own, he's in a bed and he's in a room with six or eight people.
The aged care home was emptied without notice by operators Help Street, claiming their staff hadn't been paid by the facility's overarching aged care provider, PeopleCare. Mrs Cook is appalled at how it was handled.
It's absolutely disgusting what they've done. You know, they said they care for the patients. How do you care for the patients when you take everything that's supposed to be there for them to have? There was not a knife, fork or spoon. They took all the stuff out of the kitchen.
Late this afternoon, Lorraine Cook was shocked when she checked her bank account.
While all this fracas was going on yesterday, they took money out of everybody's account early, and I think they took $1,600 and something out of the account.
Private aged care facilities come under federal law. The Aged Care Quality and Safety Commission visited the facility this morning and in a statement says it's sending staff out to visit each relocated resident to check they're safe and well. It's also going to review PeopleCare's recent compliance with aged care rules. The company has had sanctions imposed before, in 2016 and 2017, for management and care problems. Louise Beattie is the founder of Aged Care Steps, an organisation specialising in aged care advice. She says the law will require PeopleCare to prove it's managed its finances properly.
There's a range of ongoing requirements that providers need to be meeting around the way care is provided, the way the facility is operated, the management, the financial management as well. And the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commission has a role to review those parameters.
And she says the provider is responsible for rehoming every resident.
The provider needs to help facilitate the transfer of residents to other care providers if they're shutting down or if they're no longer able to provide the care needed. And usually you'll find the government department will step in and help facilitate that as well.
In situations like these, a lot of people go straight to saying, well, this is what happens in a private system. You know, if it was a government-owned system, then perhaps this wouldn't be allowed to happen. Is that the case? Could something like this be avoided if there were no private aged care facilities?
No, I don't think that makes a difference. I think whether they're private-owned facilities is not really the issue here. And there has been, I mean, one of the large problems we had was in South Australia with one of the facilities over there. That was a government-operated facility for a while as well.
While legal requirements may be able to mitigate ongoing problems for residents, there is nothing to stop another aged care home suddenly closing. Solicitor Christine Smythe says it's a matter of ethics.
The issue here is that the nursing home, the aged care facility, has its first duty, first and foremost, to the people in the home, not to its profits and not to its pockets.
Solicitor Christine Smythe, our reporter there, Isabel Rowe. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, you can find me at Linda Mottram. Ahead, after plastic bags and drinking straws, another front in the war on waste. This time, doctors and nurses call out hospitals.
Syringes, kidney dishes, single-use instruments, and of course all the packaging that the instruments come in are also plastic. Quite vast volumes. Every operation probably collects at least a bin of plastic.
A prominent security researcher is warning the cost to the Australian economy of organised drug crime is skyrocketing, and he says the massive police drug raids we regularly see in this country are ineffectual. Southeast Asia is a crucible with an explosion in synthetic drug production there and a trade enabled by weak governments and globalisation. In 2017, the Australian Crime Commission estimated the cost of organised crime to Australia had doubled since the last report, from about $15 billion to $36 billion. And Dr. John Coyne, who heads the Border Security Program at the think tank the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, is expecting that cost will have doubled again by this year. He says big policy changes, including pill testing for young drug takers, are now needed. We spoke first about the flaws in Australia's current drug policing model.
We're working on this sort of dated model, and the model goes a little bit like this, which is if the more drugs we seize, the less that will be available in the community, the higher the price will be, and the less attractive it will be for people to join criminal organisations. Now, there are a number of issues that challenge that. At the very top of that list is the globe has gone into overproduction, or rather organised crime groups have gone into overproduction, of just about every drug type. So heroin oversupplied globally, cocaine, new levels being of production of coca plant from South America. You know, we're talking about exceeding the levels that were done in the 80s. The production of synthetic drugs like ice and MDMA have gone through the roof. So these sorts of organisations, they're just making more drugs, and it's just become a cost of doing business. For those who sort of sit there and go, well, that can't possibly be right, if we look at the wastewater monitoring program, the story is very clear. For two whole years, this country has been locked in a battle with methamphetamine, or ICE, and the use of ICE remains unchanged according to that wastewater monitoring program, at best. At worst, it's increasing slightly.
Can you just flesh out a bit more about why that drug production has cranked up so much, particularly in our region in Southeast Asia? What's going on there?
In the jungles of Myanmar, we have a whole heap of essentially lawless and unpoliced zones. In those zones, they are able to pretty much do criminals whatever they like with impunity. What we also have is a massive, over the last two decades, increase in the production of chemicals and pharmaceutical products in mainland China. What we're seeing is a bleeding out of those chemicals, and they're going down into Myanmar. What we're also seeing is massive investments regionally that are improving the flow of people and goods across borders, which allows those who produce drugs to be able to move them across. The ASEAN miracle, so the Association of Southeast Asian Nations miracle over the last two decades of economic growth, we're seeing a massive growth in the region's middle class, and along with that comes a massive demand for drugs. And unlike production of drugs like heroin, you can produce this stuff all year long. It's a perfect storm of chaos for law enforcement, where production just continues to grow and grow.
And just, I guess, in parenthesis, it sounds like China's Belt and Road Initiative, this giant global infrastructure initiative it's got boiling, it might actually have the unintended consequence of further facilitating this trade.
Look, absolutely. ASEAN's creating, because they're getting new ports built, new bridges, new roads and new trains, they're being forced to integrate their border control mechanism for economic reasons. And what's happening with that is that's lowering the level of border activity in terms of law enforcement. So it is having that unintended consequences, and the ASEAN countries are really trying to play catch up with that. And I think there's a really important role there for us to build capacity in the region in terms of fighting these drugs at their source.
And does this mean that we need to finally abandon the notion of the war on drugs?
I think that Australia has been very fortunate. If we look back, and the terrible heroin crisis that Australia, it devastated us for a period of almost a decade and a half. And our national illicit drug strategy was different from the Americans' war on drugs. It was based on a three-legged stool. Number one is reduce the amount of supply or drugs in our community. Number two was through education and other mechanisms, reduce the demand. And number three was to put a safety net and minimise harm. But I think there is room for us. The idea of arresting addicts and criminalising addiction is wrong. Secondly is that, you know, the idea that we shouldn't be doing pill testing and saving kids' lives simply doesn't work for me. And I think that we need to look at this as, you know, through multiple lenses, which is how we worked it as a nation in the 90s to deal with heroin.
Border Security Program Director with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, Dr. John Coyne. Political pushback has created an early sense of uncertainty about whether Australia will press ahead with Indigenous constitutional recognition after the Minister Ken Wyatt's speech on Wednesday pledging a referendum within 3 years. The plan has a lot of potential ingredients, but the one causing the most intense debate is the call for an Indigenous voice to Parliament. A few government backbenchers quickly indicated opposition to the idea of entrenching that in the Constitution, while others said they needed to see the fine print. But many Indigenous people, those who are not in the political process, have told us that the voice is a vital ingredient and they want it to have real power. Some reflections on models in a moment, but first, David Sparks reports.
The nation's first peoples have been celebrating their heritage at NAIDOC events around the country. But this year, they're also being asked to consider what recognition in the Constitution should look like, and it's no simple task.
I think we do need the voice there, because how better will the government understand us?
In Darwin, Eileen Cummings says recognition must be accompanied by a voice to Parliament, and whatever the final model is, it must be designed in collaboration with the people it will affect.
The government still has to come back to the people, back to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples of this country, so that they can talk to us and see what we really want. They have to make the effort to come to us and talk to us so that we can actually say to them, this is what we want in the Constitution.
Debate about whether there should be an Indigenous voice to Parliament has restarted after a timeline for recognition was outlined by the government this week. But having that enshrined in the Constitution is rejected by some in the government, including Peter Dutton.
We're not in favour of a third chamber or a separate voice. We've got a very strong democracy.
The Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt, hasn't ruled anything out, but he says enshrining such a body in legislation rather than through a referendum could be considered.
If the voice fails in any referendum, and if we were to put it up and it was not going to be accepted, then it is folly. We have to be very judicial and wise in our judgments about how we take this forward. And sometimes we have to use legislative processes.
Those who are in favour of having a voice to Parliament are arguing over whether it should have an advisory role or a more solid decision-making role. Delilah McGillivray is at another NAIDOC celebration in the Sydney suburb of Redfern.
The Indigenous voice in Parliament needs to be more than an advisory body. You know, when we think back, there's been all sorts of committees. There's the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission. You know, there's been so many, government arrangements set up that really haven't made any difference. So a voice in Parliament clearly has to be, you know, enshrined in the Constitution. There has to be an instrument that allows our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander representatives of that voice be able to develop policy or develop legislation, design the legislation and the policies and the programs and have a budget to go with it.
Also at the Redfern celebrations is Leanne Townsend.
I don't think it should be an advisory body. We've had histories of advisory bodies, including the National Indigenous Council, which was to inform and established by the Howard government. It kind of dissipated. It wasn't connected to community.
Then there is the question of how people would be appointed as members of such a voice to Parliament. Delilah McGillivray wants a model based on regional representation. Other elements of this debate include a statement within the Constitution recognising that Indigenous people occupied Australia long before Europeans arrived, and the removal of the special race power clause in Section 51. Leanne Townsend says while some changes put to the vote at a referendum might be symbolic, the importance of that should not be underestimated.
It's significant to hold a referendum. We understand that. It's a whole nationwide exercise. So I think we go with our best intent in doing all that we can at this time, because it could be decades, if not centuries, before we get it together to have that opportunity.
Leanne Townsend at Redfern in Sydney today. David Sparks with that report. While there are those popular calls from First Nations Australians for an empowered voice in our political process, many of the hundreds of leaders involved in these processes so far are more measured. Danny Larkin is a Bundjalung woman and a lawyer. She's an advocate for the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and her work looks at examples like Canada and New Zealand, where Indigenous voices have been incorporated into political processes already. But when we spoke, I asked her first whether the criticisms from the government's backbench this week doom the process Ken Wyatt announced even before it begins.
I don't think so. I think I was expecting a reaction like that, likewise with probably most Australians. It's a huge change, and we haven't had the opportunity in campaigning to the rest of Australia so far as education goes with what this voice means. And so that needs to be rolled out, you know, in a thorough way. And I think once that process begins to start, things will hopefully change. I have hope. I think really it's just there's a few sort of misconceptions surrounding the functions of the voice and what it would be. But I think once those sort of anxieties are settled, and that just comes through actually being informed, and that'll happen later throughout the co-design process, that hopefully those tensions will sort of fade away.
And what do we mean by the co-design process? I mean, what is going to happen next?
I mean, ultimately, if we're looking at really applying self-determination to this, which is what the Statement from the Heart calls for, this is going to be looking at, you know, co-designing and working in partnership and negotiating and having discussions equally. So that's going to be Indigenous Australians with the Australian government. But I think the biggest thing about the co-design process is ensuring that it really picks up the thorough consultation that's been had with all the 13 dialogues in even just preparing for the Uluru Convention that happened in 2017, you know, making sure what the consensus is amongst community for what we're asking for to be recognised, which is obviously substantial forms of recognition, that they be considered and listened to and investigated.
The focus has been on the idea of the voice to Parliament, and the suggestion from some has been that this would be a third chamber of Parliament. Now, we've heard eminent constitutional experts describe that today as nonsense. But what would a voice look like? Are there examples, practical examples, we can start talking about now?
Yeah, look, in terms of the structure, the voice model, we're at a very preliminary stage right now. That would come after this co-design process has been established, and we haven't even gotten there yet. But there are some real viable options that we can look abroad to in, you know, similar Commonwealth countries like Canada and New Zealand, say, for instance, that we might make a different kind of prototype that would fit Australian wants and needs. And there's certainly been those types of suggestions within the reports and within the discussion so far over the last 10 years. So I would like to see those sort of come to the forefront in terms of, you know, how are we going to structure this? But it's certainly not a third chamber, though. The fact that it doesn't have any veto power immediately knocks it out as a third chamber of Parliament. It's merely an advisory body. It's quite a modest request given the historic oppression politically, culturally, that Indigenous Australians have faced in this country. And I think ultimately, it makes for anyway a better law and policy making process for all Australians. It shifts the consciousness of federal politicians to take into other broader considerations that really relate to culture and other society sort of issues that, you know, our First Nations are continuously up against. And we can move forward from that. There's a real healing and reconciliation just in and of that process.
Bundjalung woman, lawyer Danny Larkin. Well, in recent years, there's been quite a focus on the sheer amount of waste we produce at home, from drinking straws and plastic bags to food wrapping. But what about the waste we produce when we go to the doctor or have surgery? Well, nurses and doctors say the whole healthcare industry is battling a waste crisis, with many items that were once reused over and over again now single use and thrown straight in the bin. Amelia Turzon has been taking a look.
This operating nurse at a private hospital in Sydney watches what goes in the bin at the end of every surgery.
A lot of the single-use items include syringes,
They include kidney dishes, single-use instruments such as diathermy, light handles that are made of plastic. Every operation probably collects at least a bin, or I don't know how big, but a bin of plastic.
And how are you feeling at the end of an operation when you just see a big bin full of this stuff?
Yeah, from an environmental standpoint, it's quite devastating. Not knowing where it's getting processed, I guess, is the next, struggle.
Do you know where it goes?
No. Short answer would be no.
Go back just a few decades, and many items in hospitals, like surgical gowns or metal instruments, were used over and over again. But that is no longer the case, with the rise of single-use plastics, and even metal instruments like tweezers are now only used once and then thrown away. The Australian Medical Association's Dr. Ken Sing Lim says it's an issue across the whole industry.
This is not a problem only in hospitals. This is a problem with the whole health industry. We have become more and more reliant on single-use items than items which require a lot of packaging. The rationale behind a lot of this is that it is about trying to reduce or minimize the risk of spread of illness or disease. However, there is a very strong argument that we have gone over the top with this.
Mayam Godrat is a research fellow at Western Sydney University, and she's been trying to figure out how much waste hospitals and clinics in her region are producing.
They keep producing this waste without measuring it. They just generate this waste and then dump them.
The Victorian Public Healthcare System's latest estimates have it producing more than 40,000 tonnes of solid waste every year alone, with just a fifth of this being recycled. But some hospitals and clinics are trying to do better. Forbes McGain is an anaesthetist that got fed up with all the waste being generated at his workplace, Western Health Private Hospital in Melbourne.
So you were throwing out the drug trays you used, the anaesthetic breathing circuits, the plastic in terms of dishes and the gowns. They're all being thrown away.
So he decided to push for a waste audit and a financial analysis to see if single-use items were actually cheaper in the long run.
And what we showed, in fact, was that it wasn't correct, that the assumption that disposable was better and cheaper was not correct.
The hospital ended up bringing back some reusable items, and it's now saving $100,000 a year.
We have reusable drug trays. We have reusable laryngoscope blades, which is what you use to put, tubes down people's throats. We have reusable face masks. I really want to stress that reducing and reusing is actually more important than recycling because it saves more money. And it's actually a better outcome overall.
The hospital has been recycling some items that can't currently be reused, mostly PVC items like saline bags. After rolling out at Western Health, the scheme is now collecting about 15 tonnes every month of PVC items from 170 hospitals nationally and then recycling it at a facility in Victoria. That's a conversation our nurse in Sydney is now wanting to have too.
Yeah, I've spoken to a few colleagues and they're now sort of looking how management would feel if we were to address this issue in a larger space.
One of the operating nurses who get to watch all the stuff that's thrown away where she works, Amelia Turzon, with that story. I'm Linda Mottram, and that is PM. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Until next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Ruby Jones.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Over the summer, five people died after overdosing on drugs at music festivals in New South Wales.
That's a lot, and it sparked an inquest into those deaths, which this week has been looking at what went wrong and if strategies like pill testing and amnesty bins could save lives.
Most states don't support that, so today we find out if this is the moment that could change their approach.
That's The Signal. You can find us every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever else you get your podcasts.